Come to the third presentation in this sequence, which forms a set and has a harmonic that runs through it. The set is called the Parayana, the way beyond. And the first use of the Sanskrit word Parayana was about 2,500 years ago. After the Buddha had his Parinirvana, his death, his demise, his translation into Nirvana, all of his presentations, which were called sutras, because the Sanskrit word sutra means thread, and it meant that the presentation, the discourse of the historical Buddha, always had a thread that ran through it. The difficulty for them was that there were thousands of monks and there were some 1,700 presentations that were major, that were remembered. And so it was decided about 100 years after the Buddha's Parinirvana, which would have been around 480 BC, so about 380 BC, there was a conference that was held in the city of Vasili to try to understand how could we group the thousands of sutras of the historical Buddha and have them written down, because not everyone is going to have the indelible mnemonic capacity which we have been blessed to have. The large sutras, they were grouped according to length, length of pages, length of time to deliver. And there were 37 large sutras, and they were grouped together, and the groups were called Nikayas, or baskets. The Digha Nikaya are the long sutras of the Buddha. The middle-length ones, the Majjhima Nikaya, there are 151 of those, they were grouped together. And then all the rest of them were grouped according to the numbers of verses, starting with single verse, double verse, going all the way up to 8 verses, the octads. And when the octads were finished, they realized that the first group of the smaller sutras of the Buddha should be an index to the way in which one learned to hear the Buddha, not so much in just the sutra form, but by that time the dialogue form had come into play in an indelible way. The Greek dialogue was initiated by the development of Greek tragedy and Greek comedy with Aeschylus about the 470s BC. And Plato began his dialogues about the time that the Buddhist sutras were written down in the 380s BC. And so the dialogue form, because there was contact all the time, the dialogue form was chosen as the index for the way in which one hears the Buddha. And that group was called the Parayana. And that little group in the Parayana starts off with a sutra that consists of 16 questions and answers, 16 questions to the Buddha and 16 responses from the Buddha. But originally, there were only 8 questions and 8 responses. So it was a set of 8 and 8, and they doubled it to 16, because by that time it was well understood that a moment of thought a cheetah, can in high-powered yoga, in the Buddha's immense precision, a moment of thought can be seen to have 16 parts. 8 parts of a moment of thought can be discursively separated, and the other 8 do not separate, but they occur as a trill. That's my word. So there are 8 parts that you could designate as notes, because they have in between them a space that is not the note. And so the 8 parts of a moment of thought that have spaces in between them literally have zeros in between those 8 parts of thought. The other 8 parts of a moment of thought have no spaces because they do not have zeros between them. Instead, in the really high Dharma that was finally mastered many hundreds of years later, in the really high Dharma, not just the Dharma of the historical Buddha, but the development beyond the historical Buddha, some 500 years after his time, saw that the reason that the other 8 parts of a moment of thought could not be separated is that they do not have zeros or spaces in between them. What is between them is infinity, so that they always occur together, not as a gestalt, because that would be a form. They are not a form at all. They are a movement without boundary in infinity, in a field of infinity. And that field of infinity allows for their constellation together to occur spontaneously. There is no time for them, because in infinity, there is no time. Whereas the other discursive 8 parts of a moment of thought, there is a time sequence, though it is very quick. How quick is it? Thought is swifter than nanoseconds. In fact, it's swifter than femtoseconds, which is the speed of chemical molecular reactions. It's swifter than attoseconds, which is atomic movement time. Thought, though it is almost instantaneous in its discursiveness, has a finite speed. And so the zeros in a very high-powered dharma can be discerned. And when they're discerned for the first time, that moment of thought becomes the thought of enlightenment. It becomes the seed. It's called then the bodhicitta. And the bodhicitta, once you have mastered the resolution to that moment of thought, time now no longer has a present, but has a presence. And in that presence, the infinities and the zeros swirl in a complementarity. And in that complementarity, we have, in our time being presented here, a new presentation of the Parayana. The field of nature is a zero field, but the field of consciousness is an infinity field. The field of differential consciousness as an infinity field can be characterized in a triad of ways. And so I'm presenting for you a mnemonic, so it is possible for you to more quickly be able to group your approach to the complementarity of an infinity field in a zero field, so that your sense of time, instead of being the present, which is different from the past, which is not yet, but is different from the future. When you're presenced rather than present, the present will have a point. Presence instead has the woven paired fields. Presence is both capable of being presenced zeroly, as in Tao, as in Zen, or presenced infinity, as in stepping outside the cosmos, called eternal in ancient wisdom. Here are the three ways, the triad of ways, which we can characterize an infinity field, and they're taken from the great transform that was made of the historical Buddha and his method passed on from elder to elder, and the Sanskrit word for elder is Thera, T-H-E-R-A, Thera, and their path was the Theravada, the path of the elders. And its transmission was elder to youngster, who then became an elder, passed it to the next youngster. And so it was, as Lama Karma Tinley said to me one time, he said, the lineage was like lighting a candle from a previous candle that was lit. But that really esoteric developments, several orders beyond the Theravada, in the Vajrayana, there is an esoteric lineage where it is not a lineage of lighting a candle from another. It isn't that the rebirth happens after someone has gone through the bardo and then is reborn like a Dalai Lama or like a Karmapa. Those are lineages of candles to candles with a bardo in between. There's an esoteric lineage, which is like the drops of water in a waterfall. And so the word that is used mathematically is that it is a cascade. A cascade is a movement in an infinity field that does not have the need to have discursive quanta. And so it isn't a question of lineage, it's a question of contacting the field. And when you have access to contact the field, it immediately is displayed and does not display that unless you forget or unless you didn't know how you made contact. Or unless your contact was so fleeting that you thought it was just an insight. You thought it was just a moment of a flash of an idea, just some kind of beatific moment. What this kind of learning is for is a wisdom learning to mature our strength of staying in that bodhicitta. Whether it's zeroed or infinity, or it's discursive, or it's a cascade, that all of it is, quote, workable. Here are the triad of ways. The first way is the theoretic way. The second way is the romantic way. The third way is the mystic way. The theoretic way leads to science. The romantic way leads to art. And the mystic way leads to the Parayana, which means literally the way beyond. If you would like to characterize these with traditional language words. The mystic matures to yoga, which delivers wisdom. The theoretic matures to analytic and delivers truth. The romantic matures to aesthetic as beauty. And so the time-honored phrase is wisdom, truth, and beauty. The wisdom as the sciences and the beauty as the arts were paired together in the Renaissance in the transform of the medieval university to the Renaissance university as the College of Arts and Sciences. But always in the background was the third, which was wisdom, which was theoretical. And that wisdom in the Renaissance used the word that was used in classical times by a contemporary of the historical Buddha, by Pythagoras, and he said this is love of wisdom. Not just wisdom, but when it's work woven, braided with truth and beauty, it's not just wisdom, but it's love of wisdom. Philosophy. Philosophy. Love of wisdom. One becomes a lover of wisdom, and in which case, one is no longer an isolate individual. The love makes a sharing, and the sharing is not limited to just two or three, but whoever is sharing that presence becomes companionable together. And so wisdom, braiding truth and beauty together, delivers the set out of which thought occurs as a structure and as a transcendental flow together, delivers a complementarity. And the eight discursive parts of a moment of thought become a characterization of presence, and the infinity of the other eight as a trill allows for that together to become a complementarity. And what becomes a deep complementarity is actually infinity and zero. But the way in which the zero resonates harmonically to that is to produce ones, to produce unities by any number that is possible and needed. If you need 8 trillion stars, you can have them. If you need 8 quadrillion electrons per square centimeter, you can have them. Each one will be one and will be discrete and distinct quanta because there are zeros in between them. And about 109 years ago, a brilliant man named Max Planck characterized what the number would be for Planck's constant of the quanta, the smallest quanta he could get to. And in mathematics, it was given the letter H. So Planck's constant H was always worked into mathematical equations, and that's the reason for that was the discovery 4 years before of the electron by J.J. Thomson in England at the Cavendish. We are just now, at the beginning of the 21st century, coming upon a new threshold that has really not been developed before, and so it's original. And that is to be able to present a new kind of mathematics where there are not just unities punctuated by zeros, a zero field, but that there are companionabilities that are linked together by an infinite field. And that's what's being presented here for the first time. if we look at theory, and the Greek word for theory, theoria, actually means contemplation. A theory is the contemplation vision that is put into the symbolic structure of thought by an interesting kind of an exchange. In vision, the visioning that one has occurs almost like an insight, almost like a tab of something hidden which one can now follow and figure it out. And the term figure it out means to give it a ritual, practical time shape. And so when we have someone who says that they developed this theory at 3 o'clock in the morning while they were asleep and they quickly woke up and went with pencil and paper and began to work this out, the person who actually did this and wrote this up was Richard Feynman, who was looking at the zoo of subatomic particles in the early 1960s. There were more than 100 subatomic particles, and no one knew. There must be some simpler structure. There must be some supergrouping. And Feynman, who was at Caltech, just here in the suburb of Los Angeles, had just looked at all the experimental data of another professor at Caltech, Murray Gell-Mann, and had puzzled over this subatomic particle zoo, and suddenly he got it that what was being talked about by Professor Gell-Mann made perfect sense if you were able to go into taking the points. Gell-Mann had just been reading James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, and one of the phrases in there of the smallest point that Joyce in Finnegan's Wake could come up with is the word quark. Quark in old German means nonsense. Old ancient Yiddish German speakers like my grandmother said quatsch instead of quark. It meant my word is junk. It's just junk. We don't know what it is, and we don't know how to deal with it, so it's nonsense. Feynman saw that it was not nonsense at all, because quarks were not ones. They were one-thirds, or they were two-thirds. They were not ones. And that the deception was the habit of thinking in terms of unities, of integrals, whereas the quarks were on the level below unity, where one-third and two-thirds paired. And it was only by their pairing then, but the pairing was interesting because it was a companionable pairing. Not only could two pair together to make one, but three could pair together to make one as well. And that this was like the secret. It wasn't until maybe 20 years later that someone figured out that this was an ancient Egyptian genius insight that allowed them to do all their engineering in the Pyramid Age. The Egyptian mathematics, not based like ours on Arabic numbers and so forth, was capable of finding two-thirds of anything. Odd situation. But by doing so, they were able to do like interfaces where if you put two-thirds together, you had one and a third, which allowed you to put a third two-thirds together and get one that was a pair. And so ancient wisdom and modern physics came together. And in 1962, Murray Gell-Mann was talking to an Israeli professor who was lecturing at Caltech, who had come up at the same time with the same insight, and so the two of them wrote quickly a book together called The Eightfold Way, that the historical Buddha had been right, that by having thirds, by having a triad, one can have sets of eight or sets of 10. And so the way in which the subatomic zoo was settled in the early 1960s, by 64, 65, everyone was talking about, this is uncanny. What else is there in ancient wisdom if the Buddha was right about the Eightfold Path? And a brilliant young physicist decided that he would write a book called The Tao of Physics. That somehow, if one went back to the ancient Tao, one had an interesting thing. Here, Free Jeff Capra, published, incidentally, not as a book. Its first publication was here in Los Angeles in the Zen Journal of the Zen Center, Maizumi Roshi. And next week I'll bring a copy of that issue of the Zen Journal that has the same cover that then the Shambhala paperback had, and it was there several years before. Tao as a zero spontaneously is a complementarity with Te, which is always the unity, the one. So for instance, the Tao Te Ching is not the yin-yang Ching, it's the Tao Te Ching. The yin-yang are polarized pairs in the Te. They together, when they are together as one, now they're not polarized anymore and they have an immediate complementarity with the Tao. So not only can there be a Taoist master, there can be a Taoist couple master. And that's expandable, so it can be a Taoist community master. And there can be such a thing as a mankind that is masterful together in the Tao, and that's called a star system civilization. So we're looking at the way in which the Parayana is our current transform of our species and of our planet, of our minds, of our ways of thought, of taking time out of its present and giving it a presence which then makes a paired harmonic so that the future is always paired to a new past. And that means that that presence is expandable up and down all the dimensions of space-time with four other dimensions of the ecology of consciousness and a ninth dimension of the complementarity of those four plus four woven together, and not only a ninth, but hidden until it emerges, a tenth. When you put these eight fingers together, all of a sudden, not only does a thumb come up as a complementarity ninth dimension, but a tenth dimension, a hyperspace, which is a form. It is a hyperspace. Now you have the M theory of string theory that's current. And we have talked about Michio Kaku's wonderful book a little while ago on hyperspace and on the revision of his introduction to string theory. What's interesting is that string theory has 11 dimensions. That 11th dimension occurs because hyperspace, being a hyper form, also yields universally, eternally. This is how it is. It yields the zero field of nature fertile, so that nature is fertile to continue making phenomenality with breaths of the zeros always airing it out, aerating it, and able to, without missing a breath, have infinite breath, the breath of the eternal, which was the subtitle of the Bhagavad Gita that Aldous Huxley and Swami Pravananda translated and Christopher Isherwood some long time ago here in Los Angeles at the Vedanta Center. The Upanishads are the breath of the eternal, and the Bhagavad Gita is the Upanishad of the Upanishads, because in between is the historical Buddha's threshold of transform, which was juiced up 500 years later by someone sent to India named Thomas, St. Thomas. And he was sent to India by Jesus. And he was sent to India because it was the farthest reach with one hand that was balanced by the farthest reach with the other hand, which was sent to the Irish Sea. Bordering the Irish Sea is Ireland, Scotland, Wales, the west of England, anciently called Britain. And the same people who were in Britain were in an area of France, used to be called Gaul, called Brittany. And so the Britons and the Brittany are the same people. They're related. They're tribal, same tribe, the Belgae. The masterful figure of that whole Irish Sea was a king of the fishery ports that all centered around the Irish Sea and had ports and boats and customers in Ireland, in southern Scotland, in Wales, in the west of Britain. His name in Welsh is spelled L-L-Y-R. In Irish, ancient Gaelic, it's spelled L-E-R. The Scottish spelling was L-E-I-R, and Shakespeare's spelling is L-E-A-R, King Lear. King Lear married a woman named Penarden. Penarden's father was the king of the Cornish coast. His name was King Belly Mawr, M-A-W-R. We have a women's university in the east called Bryn Mawr. King Belly Mawr married the mother of Penarden, and her name was Anna. And Anna was the niece of Jesus. Her mother was named Susanna. And the name Susanna comes from the episode from the book of Daniel, Susanna and the Elders. And because Jesus' family were contrary to popular mythology, they were very learned and very sophisticated. Susanna's husband was Joseph of Arimathea, who was one of two men who took Jesus down from the cross, went to Pontius Pilate and claimed the body because he was married to one of the four sisters of Jesus. And he was also one of the wealthiest Jews of the time because he ran the trading route that went from the Phoenician coast, Tyre was the port, all the way to the Irish Sea, and all the ports in between. And the original people who developed that trading route 1,000 years before were the Phoenicians. But they stayed in the Mediterranean, and they went out through Gibraltar And so you find Phoenician ports all along the Atlantic coast of Africa, all the way down to the Cameroons, 3,000 years ago. All the way up the, what is the Portuguese and Spanish coast. And they founded Carthage about 800 BC in order to give them a presence. Usually the Phoenicians liked ports on islands off the coast so that everyone understood they're not here to conquer, they're here to trade, to do business. Their home port, Tyre, was an island off the coast, and that's why they were so successful. And when Alexander the Great laid siege to Tyre, he conquered it because he built a mole out. Took him many months to have rocks and so forth so that he could put his army on. But he got the idea that Tyre was a great world-class port. And so when he saw the site for Alexandria and he saw the island of Pharos off the coast, he used the Phoenician archetype to build Alexandria. But the Semitic traders were not just Phoenicians. They were really international business people who liked to explore new ways of doing business. And so they realized the Atlantic Ocean has a lot of storms and you can only do business a few months out of the year. And there are some months where you can't go out because it's too stormy. Hurricanes. But if you go to Marseille, which was formed about 600 BC, and you go up the Rhone River, you can go up quite far before you get to a place that has a side stream that goes to the west just far enough to go into a little valley. And that if you did a small portage from the end of that little stream to that valley, over one little ridge, you came to the Loire River, which went all the way up the rest of the way through France and curved around to the Atlantic Ocean, so that you could have a year-round trading route. And all along the way, you were able to trade not only with the Irish Sea complex, but with the entirety of the core of Gaul and all the rest of the Mediterranean back. And one of the things that was prized that they brought was tin. One of the few places in the world that had extensive tin mines. You need tin to make bronze or brass. You can't make it without that. And so it became an indispensable quantity for the civilized world. It was almost like having the only oil field in an industrial civilization. Fabulously wealthy. A partner in that business with Joseph of Arimathea was Nicodemus, who helped take Jesus down from the cross. And the father of Lazarus and his sisters, Martha and Mary Magdalene. So those families were enormously international and wealthy. And we're going to take a break. And we're going to take a look at the way in which the fulcrum of the far west and the far east was in Alexandria. Because that's where all the trading routes from the west came together with all the trading routes to the far east. And the family that owned the trading routes from Alexandria to India was Philo of Alexandria. Let's take a break.